So on this meditation retreat, there are many, many things which you have learnt, I hope. But one of the stories which I'm going to begin with to get everyone in the mood, which is a general story about meditation. And I think a few of you have heard this before, because I like telling this on most retreats. It was about the monk, an old monk, who would go wandering from place to place. And it was a beautiful time of a monk's life, where usually after 5 or 6 years of being a monk, when you had your basic training and you knew how to live by yourself, we would leave the monastery with everything we owned on our backs. Just your bowl, your robes, and just usually an umbrella with a mosquito net. We could drape that on the outside so we could sleep anywhere. And it was a strange thing to say, but when you were sitting meditation in your mosquito net in the forest, in the jungle, even if you saw a snake slither past, you felt somehow safe, even though it was only a little mosquito net between you and the fangs of death. But even so, that's how we used to live and spend months just in the forest, in the jungles, in the mountains. But you had to know what to do, because even Ajahn Chah would give us the advice that in those jungle areas there were elephants, and the elephants were fine, they would keep away from you, you keep away from them. But the difficulty was the baby elephants, because baby elephants would like to play and they didn't know who to be afraid of, who wouldn't be, who's not to be touched or played with. And so often the elephants, the baby elephants, would come towards your mosquito net tent and try to put their trunk underneath the bottom of the net to see who was inside. And Ajahn Chah told me, no uncertain times, don't play with the baby elephants. They like to play with you, very cute. It was very, sort of, I was quite shocked. He said, the most sensitive part of the baby elephant is the nose, the end of the trunk. Bang it. And I said, that might hurt the elephant. Exactly. Then the baby elephant will run away. Because if the baby elephant doesn't run away quickly, mother elephant will come. And she won't be so easy to force away, that she may sort of harm you or hurt you. So anyway, there's all these trainings. You can't just go out and camp in the forest without knowing all of the great traditions and what monks learn over those many, many years and many centuries of living in the jungles in the forest. But anyway, this was a story about a monk who was traveling through the forest and the jungles and the farmlands, and one day he came to a poor farmer's house. This is the old monks don't lie story. He came, but there's an important point to it. And it's also a nice story to tell. So he came to this poor farmer's house, and the farmer gave him some food for the day, because he was a Buddhist. And at the end of giving the old monk some food, then the farmer said, by the way, Venerable, it's soon to be the entry to the rains day, as it is for us here in Perth, just on the weekend. Have you got a place to stay yet for the rains? Because monks aren't supposed to go wandering around during that time of the year. You're supposed to stay in one place. And he said, actually, no, I haven't got a place for the rains yet. And the farmer went down on his knees, put his hand up and said, please, I invite you, Venerable, to please come and stay close to me for the rains retreat, and I will feed you, not the best food, because he's only a poor farmer, but enough good, wholesome food. And not far from here, just by in my land, next to the river, there's a very nice, peaceful paddock, and you can actually, I can build you a nice little kuti, where you can stay just for the rains retreat, and I'll look after you. And of course, people sometimes wonder, is it really expensive to look after a monk? And that was a question which was asked of this committee in UK many years ago, when the first monks, forest monks, went to stay in UK. Because a gentleman concerned, Colin Ash, he was a lecturer in economics at Reading University, and also he was on the board of the Bank of England. So he was a high-flying bean counter, as they say. So they asked him to count some beans. How much does it cost to look after a monk? So, can you afford it? So he did the sums, he took everything into consideration, and he came up eventually with a figure. And it turned out, he proudly announced, that to much amusement for many people, especially when I heard it, he said, it's much cheaper to look after a monk than to look after a dog. So you may have a pet dog in your house, or a pet cat, and how much does it cost to look after? Looking after a monk is much cheaper. And there are some similarities. Like a dog's living in a little hut in the back garden. That's called a kennel. For monks, it's called a cootie. Nice and simple. And monks, they eat out of a bowl. And you can take the dog for a walk in the morning, and you can take a monk for a walk in the morning. And they're always very happy and wag their tail. The only difference is we don't lick you. So anyway, it's not that expensive to look after a monk or a nun, especially the good ones. They don't need very much. A nice dry place to sleep at night and simple food, and they're very happy, just meditate all day. And also they keep very healthy, so you don't need all that health problems, which sometimes even with dogs, vets are very expensive. So anyway, so the monk agreed, and so he stayed there for 3 months, and every day he would go for alms food, and he's such a nice, kind monk, and he'd give nice pieces of advice, and the husband and wife were in much better harmony, and the kids were more obedient, respectful to their parents, and even the dog lived in the house. Loved that monk, and always wagged his tail when the monk came past. But after 3 months, it came the time when the monk had to leave. He went to the on alms round one morning, and he said, "Farmer, this is the end of the rains retreat now. Tomorrow morning, I will be departing." And even though the farmer knew that he was about to go, he didn't want the monk to go. He went down on his knees again and said, "Please don't go." And his wife also said, "Oh, please don't go. I don't mind cooking for you." Don't like to cook for him, but she didn't say that. "I'm very happy to cook for you." And the children started crying, and even the little dog put his tail between his legs and started whining. Everyone had fallen in love with that nice old monk, and they didn't want him to go, but the monk said, "I have to go." "But," said the old monk, "in my meditations, they have been very deep. And in one of my meditations, I discovered through the powers of meditation that there is a huge buried treasure close by here. And I want you to have it. Because, you know, you work very hard, you've got good karma. You know, you shouldn't be working so hard like this in your life. And your kids should be able to go to a good school. And even your poor little dog, you know, should have an upgrade of his kennel." And so the monk said, "But if you want that treasure, you have to listen carefully and follow my instructions to the letter." And so even though they were sad, the monk was going away, they were also quite excited that tomorrow they'd be rich, because they knew whatever the monk said had to be true. And why? Because old monks don't lie. So they listened carefully, and the old monk said, tomorrow morning, just at dawn, I want you to stand at the doorway to your poor little hut and wait for the sun to rise. And as the sun rises, I want you to pick up that bow and arrow you use to chase away rabbits and foxes or whatever else destroys your crops. And I want you to point the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. And when the sun rises above the horizon, when the disc separates from the horizon, I want you to let the arrow fly. And where the arrow flies, there you will find the treasure. And so they would listen very carefully. And then the monk left. And that night they didn't sleep very well, because they were dreaming of all the things they will buy, you know, with all that money they will come into tomorrow. And so they were up really early, just waiting and waiting, and that sun couldn't rise fast enough. And he was out there, the doorway to his house, with the bow and arrow, so early, come on sun, rise, 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 and it started to rise. And he pointed a bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun, and as the sun rose above the horizon, he shot the arrow. It went a long way. And they all ran after it. Not just him, his wife, the two kids and the dog. They were all excited. Even the dog understood that old monks don't lie, so he's going to have a really beautiful kennel soon. So, where the arrow landed, this was Asia a long time ago. So you know who had to dig the hole? The wife. He made his lovely wife dig the hole. Now that is not equity, that's not fair. And if you make your wife do all the hard work, you will find that you will get into big trouble. And that's what she did. She dug the hole deeper and deeper and deeper. And what did she find? Nothing, only trouble. Because on a morning walk, there came by this man, and he said, what are you doing? This is my land, and you can't dig and spoil other people's property, and I happen to be a lawyer. You're in big trouble. I'm going to sue you. I'm going to sue you for everything you're worth. You can't do this. You're destroying other people's land. You're going to lose everything. I'm going to even take the old rickety kennel of the dog away, because he's implicated. He was on the scene of the crime. And at that, the wife says, it's not my fault. My husband told me to do it. And the husband said, it's not my fault. This old monk said we'll find a big treasure. What did you say? Did you say, old monk, said the lawyer? Because the lawyer said, I'm a Buddhist too. And I know. Old monks don't lie. What did he tell you? I also heard the word treasure, treasure. That's with lawyers. You know how you get lawyers to smile when you take a photo of them? How do you get lawyers to smile when you take a photo of them? Don't try saying cheese. That doesn't work. If you get a line of lawyers and take their photo, you just need to say fees. That makes them smile. Fees. So anyway, the lawyer said, I'm going to sue you. Give me your details. And when they said, oh, it's an old monk told us this, and the farmer said, wow, old monk, what did he tell you? Because old monks don't lie. And so when the lawyer heard what the instructions were, he said, no, look at you, farmer. You know, you don't eat very well. You're so weak. You know, you haven't got the strength to really shoot a bow and arrow. So he said, I will do a deal with you. That tomorrow morning, said the lawyer, I will shoot the arrow from the bow. And he said, we'll split the treasure, because I know we'll find it tomorrow. We'll split the treasure, 51% to me, 49% to you, less fees, taxes, and charges, and out of the pocket expenses, and whatever the lawyers say to you. And he made the farmer sign a contract. With the dog as a witness. I made that up. We can't really have a dog as a witness, but nevertheless, you need a witness whenever you sign contracts. So the following morning, the lawyer was there at the door to the house. And when the sun came up, the disc of the sun separated from the horizon, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun. It went much further. They all ran after it. including the dog and the kids and the wife and the farmer and the lawyer who was panting away because he was fat and not very fit. But anyway, when they got to the place where the arrow was, it was the farmer's job this time to dig the hole. He dug, 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 dug really deep, and what did he find? Nothing, only more trouble. Because this time, that arrow landed in somebody else's property. It was a property of a general in the army. And he was coming by with some of his soldiers. And when he saw somebody sort of digging in his field, he told his soldiers he didn't need to go to trial. He said, cut off their heads, all of them, including that dog. The poor dog always gets in trouble. And the farmer said, look, look, don't cut off their heads yet. There's an old monk who said we'll find a treasure here. And at that old monk, the general said, look, I'm a Buddhist too. And don't start asking questions why a Buddhist is cutting off people's heads for no reason and destroying their property. That's really attachment. But the general said, what did he say? And when the general heard the instructions, I know your fault. Look, a farmer and a lawyer, what do you know about archery? That's a military science. You have to be trained by the best to be able to shoot a bow and arrow, said the general. Look, I'll do a deal with you. Forget about contracts. You know, we'll split it up three ways. And, because I know we'll find the treasure tomorrow, but I will shoot the bow and arrow. So the following morning, it was the general's, was at the doorway to the house with the bow and arrow, waiting for the sun to rise. And when the sun rose, then he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun. Now that really went a long way. Because this was an expert, a general trained in archery throughout his whole life. And they all ran after it. The general, the lawyer, the farmer, the wife, the two kids, and the dog. And where the arrow landed, they dug a hole, a big hole. And what did they find? Nothing, only real big trouble this time. Because this time the arrow fell in the garden belonging to His Majesty the King. Ooh. So the royal guard arrested them all and pulled them in front of the king, and the king looked at his general and said, General, I expected better from you. You should know of all people that to destroy the king's property is a capital offense. You were caught red-handed. There's no excuse. I will have to execute all of you, including your accomplices of that lawyer, the farmer, his wife, and even the two children, and that little dog on the scene. You all have to be executed. And at that, the general said, well, sire, the reason we were digging that hole was because an old monk said we fought, didn't he? You say old monk, said the king. Because I'm a Buddhist too, said His Majesty. What did the old monk say? And when they told what the old monk said, and the wife and the farmer, you know, said, yes, that's exactly what he said, and even the dog nodded his head to confirm that's exactly what the old monk said. And the king said, this is strange and weird, because old monks don't lie. I can't see what you've done, which was a mistake. It looks like you followed all the instructions to me. So he said, you know, I have to sort of follow the law, you know, without fear or favor. So what I will do, I'll suspend your sentence until we can find that monk and get to the bottom of this. So he put them all in a jail, you know, for a while. But it was a nice jail. The kids were happy in there. They didn't have to do any homework. And the dog was actually, he was nice. It was a nice place to stay and got well fed. And while they searched for that monk, they soon found him. And they brought him back to the palace. And in front of the king and all the other people involved, including the dog, he said, old monk, venerable, you've got these people into big trouble. They're about to be executed. Why? And the monk said, because, Your Majesty, they did not follow my instructions. So what do you mean? He said, Your Majesty, I invite you to come to that poor person's house the following morning. I would invite you to follow those instructions. And I will guarantee that you will find the treasure tomorrow morning. I'd only ask you to split it up four ways equally, and even your share, a quarter share for you, Your Majesty. That will make you so happy. How much would that change the life of these poor farmers? He said, okay, because he was interested. So the following morning, the king was there in the doorway of the poor person's house, and he was waiting for the sun to rise. And as he was standing there, waiting for the sun to rise, he looked at the monk, who was there also, and the old monk said, correct, Your Majesty. And as the sun began to rise, the king took up the bow and arrow and pointed it in the direction of the rising sun. Correct, Your Majesty. And just as the disk of the sun was about to separate from the horizon, the king pointed the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun, was about to shoot, turned to the old monk, and the old monk said, wrong, Your Majesty. That's not what I said, to shoot the arrow. I said, let it fly. Let it fly. And the king thought for a few moments. Like many archers, he was stretching the wood of the bow, pulling the string back. He had the arrow between his thumb and forefinger. He just let the arrow fall. And the arrow fell right down between his feet. That's how you let the arrow go. And it fell between his feet, where, having stepped aside, they dug a small hole. And this time they didn't find any trouble. They found a huge treasure, which they split four ways. And as a result of that big boost for the treasury of the country, the king reduced taxes. And the dog was so happy because he was given an air-conditioned two-story cootie, two-story kennel with swimming pool and a huge TV where he could watch Nature Channel and bark at cats and anything he wanted to. And also, he would eat out of a golden bowl, dog bowl, the best food you could possibly eat. And the kids went to a nice school, and the farmer and his wife could retire. And they could also come on retreats every now and again because they didn't need to work so hard. So, the moral of that story, but the old monk said, but it's more than just finding the treasure. Because sometimes we shoot the arrow of craving, of wanting, over there. When I win the lottery, then I'll be happy. Over here. When I settle all my business problems, then I'll be happy. Or over there. When I get jhana and enlightened, then I'll be happy. We shoot the arrow of craving all over the place. But if you let the arrow of craving fall right where you're sitting, you'll find a huge treasure there. The treasure of letting it fly, letting it go, letting it be. The present moment, right here, right now, is a huge treasure, more than you can ever imagine, which will keep you at peace and living happily ever after. And that is true. You know why I like telling that story and why I know it's true? Because I'm an old monk. And old monks don't lie. There's a nice and long story about why we always seek for happiness over here, over there, anywhere, except where we're sitting right now, where we actually are with what we've got. But then people say, well, it's okay for you, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you don't have too many worries and problems in our world. Of course you do. But you know how to be with them. Let them be and let go of fighting the world. So what I do, if I'm sick, if I'm tired, if things aren't going my way in life, what I do is remember the great meditation called the Emperor's Three Questions Meditation. It's all about kings and emperors today. So the Emperor's Three Questions, you may have seen that in one of my books. It's one of the key stories in the first book, Open the Door of Your Heart. And the reason it's a key story, because it's simple, but incredibly profound. Even when I first taught that at Cathay Pacific, you know, with Suri, the HR fellow who was there, he was so impressed by that story, he told me that he introduced that in the training program for staff and pilots, I'm not quite sure who else, the Emperor's Three Questions. And the story, I first came across that in a little book by Leo Tolstoy. You know, in those days when you were a student at Cambridge, you know, it wasn't, the workload wasn't that much. Because I was told by my tutors, yeah, you're here to study theoretical physics, but study other things as well. You've got this huge university with some of the greatest minds and lecturers in the world. You know, don't just eat at the same restaurant every day. Just go and explore. And explore philosophy. You know, explore ancient Greek culture. Whatever, you got the resources of this wonderful university. Make use of them, they're yours for free. And I really like that idea of, you know, you're doing your studies in physics, but also exploring other parts of the jewels of human learning. So that, you know, it's also, I was always liked reading, especially, I don't know why, I always liked reading Russian literature. Not in Russian, of course, but, you know, when the translation. And I remember just one term, I finished all my math work, all my physics work, in about the first half of the term, and had 6 weeks to do whatever I wanted. And so I started reading. I read War and Peace from cover to cover. I hardly put it down except to sleep and eat. And then I read some more of Tolstoy when he had his Emperor's Three Questions story. And, of course, it was all about religion. Because what happened, this emperor, in this story by Leo Tolstoy, he had it up to here with religion. Always arguing, who's right? My God in heaven is bigger than your God in heaven. And just always, never having any peace and happiness. It's always like having theories and arguing with one another. And he thought, there must be something wrong there. And so he was a bit of a philosopher himself, being an emperor. He decided to make up his own religion. And it became the Emperor's Three Questions religion, or philosophy. That's all he needed. And those three questions, the most important questions in the world. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? And what is the most important thing to do? So if you know the answer to those questions, what more do you need? And so after a long journey which was the biggest part of this little short story, he finally found the answers in unexpected places, in the experiences of life, rather than in the pages of books. And so, now in this telling these stories, I always like to ask each one of you, the first question is the easiest one. When is the most important time? Yeah, of course it is. Now is the only time you ever have. All the past, you can't change it. You always might say, oh, if I'd only done something else, if I'd have not invested in that stupid trust, if I'd have married somebody else, if. But the past is ineffable. You can't if the past. You don't know what might have happened. If you'd have done something different, if that girl, I was telling the other day, I think yesterday, that my longest relationship and she dumped me for another guy. If she hadn't met the other guy, what would have happened? I would have been a monk. But we can't if the past. In other words, who knows what might have happened? So, the future again is just who knows what's going to happen, how things are going to turn out. So, the only time we ever have is now, and now is where your future is made. Now is the only time you have to do anything about your future. Now. So now is the most important time. So have you packed your bags yet to go back home? Have you? What have you done that for? You're not home yet. The flight's not going to leave till, was it tomorrow or Sunday?
Sunday.
What have you packed your bags for? So unpack them. Don't pack them to an hour, half an hour, 5 minutes before the bus leaves. So you can enjoy every moment of this retreat instead of planning days ahead. So, now's the most important time. Now I'm going to skip the next one for a little bit. Oh no, let's do it in the order of Tolstoy I had. Who is the most important person? When I ask that question, so many people, because this is our modern world, 21st century, say oneself. And that really shows just one of the big problems in our modern world. Self-centered. We think that we are the most important person in the world. And of course, that's the wrong answer. So what is the right answer?
We are with.
Oh, you're spoiling it. I was just going to say, who is the most important person in the world? Ajahn Brahm. But the real answer, not messing around, the one right in front of you is the most important person in the world. And of course, that was not what I expected. I expected like God or Jesus or the Prime Minister or whatever else, or some really important person, or your mother or your father or something. And this was the one right in front of you, whoever that happens to be. And that was just really shocked me. I never saw that coming, but it made so much sense to me and changed a lot of how I looked at life, because I recognized there were times when I was a student and I wanted to go up to some big shot lecturer to actually to ask some deeper questions, even actually to point out what I thought were faults. But I was only a student, long hair, green velvet trousers, you know, that's what the uniform was at those days. And this was a professor who had more important people to talk to than me. You ever felt that? That people are trying to get rid of you? They're not giving you importance? And that felt really, really nasty. I felt rejected. Even you can go home. And, you know, your wife says, oh, darling, can you... later, darling. And of course, you know, you think you're doing the right thing, got more busy, more important things to do. You can talk to your wife anytime. But that really hurts. You feel rejected. Or just in this particular case, that, you know, somebody at work, and you're the big boss, a little person at work comes to talk to you about something, and you say, no, and they go away. You get rejected. Because the person in front of you is not the most important person in the whole world. But if you can practice that, imagine how you connect with people. If someone comes up to you and asks you something, and they are the most important person in the world, you connect. You respect them, and they respect you for giving them a few seconds of time. And it also, in the service industry, if you're a flight attendant on sort of Cathay Pacific and someone rings the bell for the attendant and you go up to them and say, ah, not now, I'm busy. Have you ever done that on Cathay Pacific? No, there was this time, there was a gentleman on the aircraft and the fellow on the aisle seat. And when the flight attendant came up to take some orders for drinks, The guy in the aisle seat said to the flight attendants, "Get me a whiskey, you bitch." Really bad speech. And the fellow sitting next to him was really surprised and said, "Can I have a cup of tea, please?" Very polite. And the flight attendant was so shocked that when she came back, she only had the whiskey. She forgot the cup of tea. So he said, "A cup of tea, please, you know, if it's not too much trouble." And in that time, this guy had downed the whiskey and so shouted out to the flight attendant, "And give me another one, you cow." Really being rude. And so the flight attendant went to the galley and got another whiskey for this really bad-spoken man and forgot the tea again. He said, "Please, a cup of tea." And then the fellow finished the whiskey again and just said, "And another one, you old pig." And the flight attendant was really, really just discombobulated. And while she was sitting there just wondering what to do, the man who wanted a cup of tea, just a simple cup of tea, realized the only way to get service on that airline was to be rude. And then so he shouted out, "And don't forget my cup of tea, you know, you old witch." Actually, that's not actually how the joke worked, is it? No. Okay, rewind the joke. The person ordering the whiskey was not a fellow, it was a parrot. Can I rewind the joke again? Okay. I'm a bit tired. So, okay, the parrot was sitting next to this man on the aircraft, and the parrot called the flight attendant and said, "Give me a whiskey, you cow." And the fellow said, "A cup of tea, please." And so the parrot got the whiskey, and the man didn't get any. Didn't get anything, so he said, "Please, don't forget my cup of tea, please." And at that time, the parrot had downed the whiskey. "Get me another whiskey, you bitch." And then just the flight attendant was just really confused and got the other whiskey for the parrot. And he said, "Oh, just a cup of tea, please, if it's not too much problem, being trying polite." And then the parrot downed the whiskey and asked for another one, "You old hag." There must be some other sort of insulting words which you can use, but you know, my vocabulary on insulting words is very, very meager, because I'm a monk. Don't hear many insulting words as a monk, so I'm trying to make them up as best as I can. And then he got another whiskey for the parrot, and so the guy thought the only way he can get service is to be insulting, and so, "And get me a cup of tea, you old witch." And so the flight attendant just went to the galley, but didn't come back with any tea or any whiskey. Just came back with two big male flight attendants, big guys. And they took the parrot and the guy out of their seats. They opened the door, which you can't do, but you know, don't spoil a good story. And they threw both of them out of the aircraft at 36,000 feet. And as they were falling, tumbling down to the ground, the parrot said to the guy, "You've really got a bad attitude for someone who can't fly." So anyway, that was just a silly old joke, which I messed up at the beginning, but there we go. So, the one in front of you is the most important person in the whole world, so that means you actually connect with them. Which means in hospitality, people realize you're not trying to get rid of them, you're actually looking out for them, you're connecting with them, you're being mindful with them. And of course, there are times when there's no one else around at all. Who's the most important person in the world then? It's yourself, because there's no one else around, and you're the most important person in the whole world. And what's the most important thing to do? It's a wonderful word, to care. Not to cure, but to care. And that became the Emperor's Three Questions. Now is the most important time. Whoever it is right in front of you is the most important person in the whole world. And the most important thing to do is to care. The word caring is a very beautiful word. It's kindness, compassion. How it actually manifests, who knows? But you're caring for this moment. Now what that means in meditation, the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. When is the only time to meditate? What's the most important object of meditation? The breath? The nimitta? No. Whatever's in front of your mind right now is the most important thing to observe in the whole world. This is the most important meditation object. Whatever's happening right now. And what do you do with this ache, this pain, this tiredness, this unpleasantness or this bliss? What do you do with it? You care. You open the door of your heart with kindness to whatever you're experiencing right in this moment. You let the arrow of craving fall. You're observing this moment. And even if you are tired, even if you are sick or in pain, if that's the object in front of your mind's eye, in front of your awareness right now, it's important. For some reason or another, it's come up to teach you something. So don't throw it away, don't push it away, don't try and find a place where you can't feel this experience. It's important, be with it. And open the door of your heart to it with kindness. Tiredness, pain, sickness, welcome. Thank you for coming back to visit me. It's been such a long time since I was depressed. Thank you for coming back again to visit me. I've missed you, anxiety. Whatever it is, you invite it in with kindness. It's here. It becomes the most important thing in the whole world. So be with it. And that becomes the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. Highly effective. Cuts through so many other problems in types of meditation because you're not choosing what you're aware of, but you are choosing how you are aware of it. You're being kind and being with it. You know what it is sometimes? Your mind is wandering off and you say, I don't want it to wander off. You're not being. The wandering mind is right in front of you, so it's really important. And then something interesting happens. Your mind doesn't wander off. It goes to different ideas and places, but you're always with it. Just like when I travel around, sometimes people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, don't you get tired traveling from here to there? And I said, I don't go anywhere. I just sit on the seat of the aircraft. The aircraft does all the moving. I just sit here. A different way of looking at things. So wandering mind, it's only because you want it to be somewhere else and it goes not where you want it to go, and you call that wandering. So, wherever your mind goes, you just hold its hand gently and go along for the ride. So you're always aware, wherever your mind is, there you are. You're not trying to control your mind. Whatever's in front of your mind right now, that's where you are. Because it's important. The trouble is, we want to be, say, with the breath, and the mind wants to go somewhere else. Who wins? The mind wins all the time. It goes wandering off. And you're standing here just thinking, when is it going to come back so I can watch my breath again? So wherever the mind goes, you go with it. Wherever the aircraft goes, I just sit down, I don't go anywhere. Just stay put. So that means now the most important time, the only time. The thing which is right in front of you, what you're experiencing right now, is the most important thing in the whole world. And the only thing I do is I care. open the door of my heart to whatever's happening right in this moment. Always here. And you know, this wandering mind can't happen. It goes somewhere and I go with it. Always next to it. Never separated. Because whatever it is, even the most things, the most unexpected things, are important. Even if they're unpleasant, they're teaching me something. I'm not quite sure yet. Maybe I'll find out later, but I keep gathering the data. Now the most important time. This is the most important thing, whatever I'm experiencing. I just care for it. I don't try and get rid of it. Don't try and hang on to it. The door of my heart's open to you. And a door is not just to come in. A door is also used to go out. It can come and go as it pleases. Because I started talking about that when people ask, well, what do you do? How can you meditate when you're sick? Or how can you meditate when you're really sick? You've got the flu, or you've got some terrible migraine, or some terrible disease. What do you do? How can you meditate when you're in difficulty like that? This is easy. You can be aware. Now, the most important time is here. And what are you aware of? What's right in your mind right now? Just because it's unpleasant doesn't mean it can't be a beautiful object of meditation. Stay with it, explore it. Let it be. And then see what happens next when you care for it rather than give it negativity. Get out of here, you don't belong. Embracing it, being with it. So that becomes a type of meditation you can do any time, any place. And a lot of time, it leads to incredible deep peace and joy. Even the story... Oh, is that really true, 8:52? I thought now's the most important time. Even... I just one last little anecdote. I was trying to just be short today and then just do a guided meditation. But anyway, when I was first couple of years in northeast Thailand, we were sleeping out, you know, in the jungles, just training and watching the snakes slither past. And I got a fever. Every Western monk got a fever in those days. It wasn't malaria fever. We didn't know what it was. It turned out to be typhus fever. And I think I mentioned a few things about that, typhus fever. And it was very, very debilitating. I mentioned the ward in Ubon Hospital, the monk's ward. Thailand was a third world country. The northeast was like the backwoods. And the forest monks, we were the tough guys in the backwoods of a third world country hospital. So that we were treated just so uncompassionately, I would say, because they didn't know what I had, so they gave a cocktail of antibiotics delivered by this nurse, this Thai nurse. Now, I know that many of you always think that Thai girls are petite and pretty and kind. This was in the northeast of Thailand. And that nurse was built more like a water buffalo. She could have competed in Olympic Games weightlifting. Honestly, she was tough, and she had to be for the following reason, because the cocktail of antibiotics was delivered by injection into your buttocks. And those needles, remember the days of recycled needles, they had to be recycled. And they were too lazy to sharpen the point, you know, on the sort of the stone before injecting you. It was really dull. I'm pretty sure they would use those needles in Bangkok, first of all. And they use needles to save costs because their health budget is really, really expensive. They send them up to the northeast to the farmers. And they use them in the main part of the hospital in Ubon. And only last of all, they would send them down to the monks' wards because we would never complain. And this nurse would come in every morning and afternoon, two injections a day. See, actually, you can't really call it injecting. Stabbing. Honestly, that really hurt. Stabbed twice a day by this nurse. And I was a very good monk, and I would do my loving kindness, but not to her. May all beings be well and happy, but not that nurse. But, you know, it was not just the unpleasant, the unpleasantness of the treatment, but it was also, you had a fever, it wouldn't go away 3 or 4 weeks, I think. And I was just getting really weak and felt terrible. And it's obviously you get some type of depression, no energy. And then I just one day, Ajahn Chah would come in, I told you that story, you'll either get better or you die. Thanks a lot, teacher. It didn't really work for me. But what did work was I was sitting down laying down one day in a fever, feeling just terrible. And then I decided, well, why not meditate? You always thought that maybe you're too sick to meditate. So I just sat down there and just, I didn't really understand the Emperor's Three Questions meditation, but that's pretty much what I did. Just was in this moment. This is now is the only time I had. And the fever, the aches, the pains, this really body which was had no juice at all in it, just laying down there. That was important for me because it was right in front of me. And instead of complaining or trying to cure this, I cared for this moment and this body. I let it be. I stopped fighting and just was with my body. And it's no exaggeration that you went into very deep meditation, you know, blissed out. And the wonderful thing was that the contrast between beforehand, when your body wasn't sort of normal, it was really sick, weak, feverish, no energy, and the ache in the bones, which happens when you have a fever for a long time, and that disappeared. The body left me, it went. You didn't float out of it. It wasn't a near-death experience. It was a meditation experience. Deep, 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 deep inside. Blissing out, I don't know for how long. And he came out afterwards, feeling $1 million. Still had the weakness in the bones and the fever, I don't think, was there. But I often wonder whether that was where the fever was overcome in deep meditation. Because I've seen that happen with other people. But certainly it was a great relief to know, doesn't matter how sick you are, how much pain, how much lack of energy, you can always meditate if you know how to do that. Now is the most important time. It's the only time. What you're experiencing right now is important. Be with it. Don't try to understand it, or control it, or gain power over it. Just, it's here, be with it. And just be kind, care for it. Open the door of your heart to this moment. Because you're making peace with it, you're not fighting it. That peace grows and grows and grows until your mind is so peaceful. It just notices the peace. And the peace naturally becomes the dominant object of your mind. And you go into the deepest of meditations, joy and happiness. You know, it's a wonderful thing to know you can do that. So if ever I get very, very sick, you know, really at death's door, I know what I can do. Just now's the most important time, this is the most important object, I'm just going to care. Simple, powerful, and you go really, really deep. That's why I wanted to share it with you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So now we do have photo time. Is that correct? Yeah. So you're going to do whatever you're going to do. Because that's why I don't know why they want to take. You've got enough photographs of me. I know what they've done over in Indonesia. You've seen those like cardboard cutouts of me. I first saw it in the Gramedia bookshop. I had a whole section of my books. Why not? Then I can go and take a rest or go meditate, and you can take your photo next to a cardboard cutout. It looks just the same.
No?
Then that's what. Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn, for his teaching.